Welcome to the Lift Every Voice podcast, where we explore books by contemplative writers of color. I'm Christine Walters Paintner.
And I'm Claudia Love Meyer. We are joined each month by the author of our book club selection. Together, we explore how increasing our diversity of perspectives on contemplative practice can enrich our experience of the Christian mystical tradition.
We encourage you to join us by reading the book, listening to the conversations, and engaging with the reflection questions on our website at abbeyofthearts.com. Welcome to the Lift Every Voice book club and podcast. I am joined by my wonderful co-host, Claudia Love Meyer, in our series of conversations on books in the Christian mystical contemplative tradition from writers of color. And we're really delighted today to have Kat Armas here with her beautiful book, Abuelita Faith, What Wisdom on the Margins Teaches About Wisdom, Persistence, and Strength. So let me just say a little bit about Kat, and then we'll have her bring her voice in. So Kat is a Cuban-American writer and a podcaster from Miami, Florida. She holds a dual MDiv and MAT degrees from Fuller Theological Seminary, where she was awarded the Frederick Buechner Award for Excellence in Writing and is currently pursuing a Master's of Theology at Vanderbilt Divinity School. Her first book, which we're discussing today, sits at the intersection of women, decolonialism, the Bible, and Cuban identity. She also explores these topics and more on her podcast, The Protagonistas, which is definitely worth checking out, and centers the voices of Black, Indigenous, and other women of color in theological spaces. And Kat is currently living in Nashville with her spouse and brand new baby while working on her second book, Sacred Belonging, a 40-day devotional on the liberating heart of scripture. So welcome, Kat. It's really a joy and a delight to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
So why don't we just start by you telling us a little bit more about who you are and specifically what led you to write this book in particular?
Yeah. So as you mentioned, I'm Cuban American and I'm originally from Miami, Florida, which I think is an important detail in my story as it really shapes how I began to understand the world and spirituality and my faith, you know, living in a city of predominantly Cubans. So my culture was the dominant culture. And then leaving that, you know, and entering, you know, just a very different context as I pursued theological studies and kind of experiencing the sort of culture shock, both spiritually and ethnically. And yeah, that's where a lot of the wrestlings began to write this book. You know, I decided to pursue theological education, being raised Catholic. I knew nothing of denominations or evangelicalism. And so I kind of went in there, you know, without any prior knowledge or experience. But yeah, and it was in that space, you know, being raised by a single mother and being, you know, there were so many details about my life that when I began theological education, I thought I was going to get closer to God or learn more about God, you know, and I really felt more distant from God. You know, I felt because so much of what I was learning was from a very specific lens, right? And it was being taught as the norm or the lens of which we should know God. And it was just very different from my lived experience. And so that was really where I began to wrestle with a lot of these concepts in Abuelita Faith, and where I began to, you know, ask the central question in my book, which is, what if the greatest theologians the world has ever known are those whom the world wouldn't consider theologians at all? And that's when I realized, you know, I'm learning from, you know, men behind a pulpit or in a classroom, which is great. We should learn from men too. But, you know, it really just felt like, very disconnected from my lived experience and very disconnected from who I was raised believing are theologians, like my grandmother, who, you know, never led a Bible study, had no formal theological education or education, period, you know. And I felt like I learned more about the divine from my community and people like my grandmother than I did from, you know, class in classrooms, and nothing against Western education. You know, obviously I have degrees, but yeah, it was a very shocking experience for me, I guess you could say. And that's where Abuelita Faith was sort of born.
Amazing story. I love that. Claudia Love, do you want to kick us off with your first question?
Kat, you said on your journey into honoring the wisdom of the women, of women in the margins, begin with what you referred to in chapter one as research grief. Could you tell us more about that and any advice you have for others that are trying to navigate that particular kind of grief?
Yeah. So research grief was really what sparked, what I specifically wrote in Abuelita Faith. And it was, you know, I was in a women in church history class and I was learning so much about, you know, amazing things that women have done throughout history and the Christian faith and you know, and as far as just faith in general. And yeah. And I realized in that moment, I'm like, you know, this is wonderful, but what about the women that, you know, whose shoulders I stand on? What about my answers? What about Cuban women? Like, what is the history, you know? And again, so much of what was presented, you know, in this women in church history class was just like history, and, you know, like, it was just like, this is everyone's history, but it didn't feel, again, like, as I mentioned earlier, personal to me. So for one of our research papers, I decided to just go deep into the history of Cuban women and just, you know, Christianity as it pertains to, you know, the Caribbean, not just necessarily Cuba, but that region of the Caribbean. And of course, you know, I knew about colonization. We had all heard about all of that. But I think for the first time, it really became personal. And I mentioned in Abuelita Faith, what really hit home was reading Miguel de la Torre's work and how he mentioned that women really bore the brunt of colonization, right? Women were obviously sexually assaulted, and they also had to work and bear children, like many women in many African-American women in the South, right? And so women bore the brunt of this. And that's where, you know, it really hit me that these colonial wounds I wear in my body, right? These colonial wounds are generational. This is not just something in the past, but in my past, you know, my grandmother, my great-grandmother, my great-great-great-grandmother, right? And so that's when I sort of like, it hit me. And I just sat in that. I sat in that grief. I sat in that generational grief. And I really, you know, I asked in Abuelita Faith and, you know, I didn't know what to do with it. And I was after sitting in that grief that I realized, well, maybe now I can get to work, right? This is where we start the process of decolonization. This is where we start the process of holding the tension, holding that grief, but also seeking out healing and seeking out, what does that mean to be a Christian, right? I talk about the faith of los humildes, right? The faith of the humble. And that's something that tension between a faith of a colonized imperial Christ, right? Believing in a colonized imperial Christ versus a Jesus that surrounded himself, and a Jesus that was, that came from, that a Jesus that is fully acquainted and standing in solidarity with the humble. And yeah, that was that grief. I just wrestled with that grief. And I really began to lean into the Jesus of Los Humildes, where, you know, I always thought I believed in that Jesus, but if the only Jesus that I'm receiving, the only Christ, the only messages are of an imperial Christ, then really what Christ do I know, you know? That was another existential crisis, you know, after so many other ones. But that led to, it was the first chapter of my book. And so that was part of the beginning part of the journey.
Do you have for someone trying to navigate that grief? Because, you know, it's just starting for some people. It started for me a few years ago, but I didn't really have much advice to how to navigate this grief. So what is your advice to us newbies in decentering whiteness in our spirit?
Yeah, that's a good question. I feel like I'm on that journey as well. You know, I need some advice too when I'm experiencing when I am experiencing this grief. I think for me, as I mentioned, it was sort of just sitting in it and letting it be what it was. You know, I think so much of the dominant culture wants us to rush past grief, or wants us to, you know, we rush past the Good Friday to get to the Easter Sunday. And, you know, there's, you know, so much of our faith is built on platitudes and, oh, well, heaven. And, you know, but I think for me, it really was digging into that grief. It was digging into that generational. And again, you know, not everybody is there. So I'm not saying we need to, you know, just dig into our trauma. But I think for me, it was yeah, just letting myself feel that pain and feel that tension, understand that those wounds live in my body, and then, you know, seeking a way that I can begin to move forward. And for me personally, it really was celebrating, elevating, honoring the faith of my ancestors and my elders and my grandmother. It was reconnecting with those roots that have been, you know, whether they've been told that it was, you know, my grandmother wasn't legitimately saved because she practiced a popular Catholicism, or, you know, there were so many messages that I received that were frankly just false, you know. And so a part of, you know, I guess maybe an advice that I can give that worked for me was kind of reclaiming that, right? Going back and reclaiming this, you know, as I mentioned, this popular Catholicism, and I say popular because my grandmother did not have access to mass, you know, and a lot of people, you know, in the rural areas, whether it was in Cuba or, you know, didn't have access to church. And so they would practice it in their homes. They would build altars, right, in their homes. And those were sacred spaces. And so for me, it is, yeah, just a reclaiming, even just in my own memories. You know, I write in Abuelita Faith of these moments that I would sit in front of the altar of a woman who helped raise me and just pray the Our Fathers and pray the Hail Marys. And I knew in that moment as a child, those were sacred, but then as an adult, I'm being told that those weren't right. That wasn't legitimate, that I needed to repent from, you know, so it is a reclaiming, a going backwards, and finding God in those moments, or refinding God in those moments, or a remembering of that time. So.
Thank you.
Yeah. I like how you describe having to dwell in that tension, because then you talk about how your women ancestors were also the ones who lived in the tension, who were the border crossers and the inhabiting the multiple in-between worlds. So I'd love to hear more about that. The image of thresholds is one that has spoken to me for many years, especially living in Ireland, where, you know, we're on the edge of the sea and there's all these portals into the other world. So what is it like for you to reclaim that, you know, the fertility of that in-between space, particularly as your women ancestors, you know, kind of reveal that, the wisdom of that to you?
Yeah, that's such a good question too. And I think that this also speaks to a little bit what you were asking, Claudia. And I think, so the first thing I want to say is I've been working on the manuscript for my second book, and I love, Christine, that you mentioned this sort of these edge zones in nature, because that was something that really captivated me, right? This idea of ecotones. A lot of people may have not heard of ecotones, but they're like, you know, those spaces of in between, like not fully, they're like the shore, for example, right? Not fully ocean, not fully land. But it's in these ecotones, these spaces where there's the most diversity, biodiversity in the world. Mm-hmm. And there's the most resilience in these species that live there are the most resilient, because they're constantly having to deconstruct and reconstruct and assemble and disassemble to the changing environments. And man, I was so moved when I read that, because that really is such a you know, a lot of what I'm trying to say in Abuelita Faith is that so many of us live in these tension zones, right? These sort of spiritual ecotones, and not just spiritual, cultural as well, ecotones. And there's a famous popular Latino and Latinx saying that is, I write in the book that we say that many of us who are, whether second generation or first generation, feel like we are neither de aquí nor de allá, right? We're not from here nor from there. Mm-hmm. But I like to reclaim that and say, wait a minute, no, what if we are both from here and from there? What if this in-between state is a holy place to be, right? Just like that ecotone is like, I mean, conservationists seek to like preserve ecotones because they feel like preserving ecotones can really even help things like climate change. And so I think, like, what if this middle space, this ni de aquí ni de allá, is, you know, a space where we can experience God? And many of us from, you know, third cultured people, and many of my ancestors who lived in this in-between, I mean, I think of not just ancestors in the past, but my grandmother, you know, who really lived, I mean, she's lived in this country for 50 years and she doesn't speak a lick of English. You know, she's like, Spanish is my language. And I, you know, this is how, I mean, granted, she lives in Miami, so it's easy, but yeah. And it's this idea that, you know, I am still holding on to both. I am still sitting in the tension of both. And I think that is something that many of us can reclaim. And I mentioned your question, Claudia, because I feel like it's this notion of reclaiming what the dominant culture has maybe tried to shame us about, or what the dominant culture has tried to tell us is less than or no good, or but no, you know, I want to make that, to continue to sit in that space, because I believe that space is holy. And also, I think that speaks to you know, the notion of decolonization. You know, again, the dominant culture sees the world in dichotomies or in binaries, you know, and I feel like sitting in the tension, I feel like reclaiming the faith of our ancestors and reclaiming these practices that live in our bodies that, you know, we may have been told are not legitimate or are evil even. To realize that that is a decolonizing, a deconstructing from the dominant culture, because we are leaning into a both and, we are leaning into a tension zone. We are leaning into things that makes the dominant culture uncomfortable. And so, yeah, I think that's something that's very important to me.
Yeah, I think it's such a powerful image because, you know, as you say, the kind of white church, white supremacy culture, you know, looks at dichotomies. And also I think about kind of the church message of, you know, trying to achieve or arrive, you know, at that right. Kind of state of perfection, as opposed to honoring the whole process and unfolding yeah. journey itself as being the journey of holiness. Yeah, beautiful.
Right. I mean, it's like the story of colonization, right? Conquering, dominating, mm-hmm. arriving, you know, yeah. And that's not what we're after. We want to, you know, it's the process for us of becoming, right? Mm-hmm. Not conquering, but being in the midst of and in the process, in the journeying.
Yeah.
So yeah.
And there's such a vulnerability to that too, you know, to say like, I am, you know, I don't know where I'm going. I don't right. know who I'm becoming.
Right.
It's so refreshing. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think of Miriam, and this is, I wrote about her in Abuelita Faith, but I just absolutely adore the detail of Miriam, you know, as they had just left Egypt and they're, mm-hmm. you know, they had just crossed the Red Sea. And it was like this moment of just, I mean, literally they had just escaped death. And she like pulls out a timbrel from her back pocket, right? And just leads the nation in song and dance. And to me, I find that fascinating. A, because she brought a timbrel with her, right? Like yeah, she was exactly. prepared to celebrate, right? And B, it was just this moment of like, I don't, you know, this is the journey. This is the becoming. This is, and we're going to celebrate as we are, you know, doing it. They didn't arrive anywhere. You know, they still had God knows how much longer to go, you know, 40 more years to go. But but she took out her timbrel, you know, I like to say from her back pocket, and just, you know, ready to dance. And so, yeah, I love that.
Beautiful.
I definitely feel what you're saying about not quite from there. And for me, it would be Africa, but not quite, you know, fully accepted here. And I think most of us African Americans, even if we're not acknowledging it, we just are. If you're African American, our history does not begin in chattel slavery. It begins in Africa, but chattel slavery is the fire that we were forged in. And even to go back to Africa, you know, when I went to Africa, there were people who said, welcome home. And then there were people, you know, that made it clear that I was an outsider. So I find that very interesting. On page 36, you write, the saints are like open treasure houses accessible to all, like flowing fountains at which everyone can drink. Nothing in the community of saints is private, although everything is personal. Could you tell us how first of all, when you became a Protestant and were being told that the Catholic Church is not the real Church of Jesus, I'm sure that the saints were an issue. I personally love the saints, but no matter who we are, how can we benefit? How can we tap into the beauty of what the saints live through and what they have to teach us and, you know, and their pool of wisdom? How do we tap into that? How do we benefit from that?
Yeah, that's such a great question. You know, it's it's funny because so much of the Bible asks us to consider the saints, right? Asks us to consider those who came before us, right? Whether it's an entire chapter in Hebrews of like the faith of our ancestors and the cloud of what, you know, there's so many images of a communal church, right? That not just the church that we see, but those who have come before us. But yet for some reason, you know, so much of evangelical theology is concerned about, you know, doing that, which I just find so interesting. Yeah, I think personally for me, you know, the patron saint of the Cuban people is someone consider San Lázaro. And I, you know, for me growing up, I remember so much these statues, these towering, and I talk about this in Abuelita Faith, these towering statues of San Lázaro, like 4 feet tall, you know, and when I was a kid, they were kind of scary, you know, because I mean, it's an image of a man with dogs licking his wounds and he, you know, but now looking back, you know, that image of San Lázaro is such an image of hope, an image of healing, an image. It is an image that is, it's shocking and it's uncomfortable to look at, but I think that that is survival, right? Survival is uncomfortable and survival is offensive, you know? So there are wounds, there are bleeding wounds and there are dogs licking those wounds. I mean, that is a perfect image of survival, right? And so for me now, you know, looking back and or thinking back of these San Lázaros and just what that meant for my people, you know, my people in exile, for them to bring their 4-foot statues. I mean, they probably didn't bring them with them, but, you know, to find them and to put them in front of their homes and sort of stake a claim of like, look, God did this, you know, this was what Jesus did for San Lázaro or for, you know, Lazarus. And this is what can be done for us, you know. I think that that is such an image of hope and an image, you know, such a beautiful image. And so when I think of the saints, I just think of all that they communicate to a marginalized people, you know, and obviously, you know, I'm sure there's different theologies of saints or, you know, different things of people. I haven't studied that aspect of it as much, but for me, it really just is, yeah, an image of survival. And there's so much that we can learn from that. You know, in Abuelita Faith, I talk about how survival is in and of itself a holy endeavor. We don't need to spiritualize survival to make it holy or sacred. And the saints are a perfect image of that, of how so many of them survived in the midst of empire, in the midst of, you know, martyrdom. And I mean, obviously they didn't survive through martyrdom, but just, you know, so much of what they went through. And that's can speak so clearly and loudly and beautifully to a marginalized people.
That's cool. Thank you.
I love how you talk about the Holy Spirit as the wild child of the Trinity. It's such a great image, and how the breath of God guided your ancestors in things like herbal knowledge and other kinds of intuitive wisdom, which is something that is very close to my heart, you know, as working with, you know, basically contemplative practice and creative arts. It's like, how do we give people access to a different way of knowing in a culture that worships the rational and a church that worships the rational? So how do you, you know, what is your perspective on that? You know, what is the gift that, you know, your ancestors offered to us, and how to reclaim some of that intuitive wisdom and learning how to trust it too, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. So this was such a fun sort of discovery as I was researching the Hebrew midwives, and I was learning about midwifery in the ancient world and how midwifery in the ancient world was like a legitimate spiritual, like it was a, they were legitimate spiritual leaders, right? Midwives. I mean, they had all sorts of embodied wisdom and embodied knowledge. And a lot of it had to do with things that they learned from the earth, you know, these herbs. And as you mentioned, you know, these sort of, whether it was oils or potions, really, I mean, that's really what they were, these herbal potions that they would put together when they would deliver children. Right. And there was so many rituals that midwives in the ancient world would practice, you know, rubbing salt on a child to protect it from certain things. I mean, these are just ancient practices. And nowadays, when we look back and we think it, not even look back, when we, whether it's hear of these practices still happening today, we consider that evil, or we consider that, you know, not of God. You know, and I think back of the perfect example for me was like essential oils, right? You know, it's so right now it's cool. And I don't know what to use essential oils and, you know, people dab it and, you know, on their bodies for all sorts of things to ease anxiety, to help with stomach pains, you know, all these sorts of things. And I was actually reading the history of essential oils and how, you know, it's been co-opted by a lot of Christians, a lot of, you know, Christian, just the dominant culture in general, Western, you know, dominant culture, as a sort of, you know, natural remedy. But this is what, you know, whether it's ancient African spirituality, not even ancient African spirituality, indigenous spirituality, and even back to like the midwives, whom, you know, we look to as our sort of spiritual ancestors or women in the Bible that, you know, Christians today are, you know, look to. Yeah. And they engaged in these sort of practices. And so, you know, what does that mean? What does that mean when we can look back and see a history of people using the gifts of the earth that God, you know, made and created for the same purposes as people do now, just repackaged in such a way that it's okay, that it's not offensive because it's used by, I don't know, Western white folks. But anyway, all that to say that I feel like there is so much that we can gather from really, again, looking back and reclaiming so much of these practices. You know, there's an arrogance to think that wasn't rooted in a wisdom of the land, that wasn't rooted in a wisdom of, you know, even a spiritual sort of wisdom. You know, again, midwifery in the ancient world was a spiritual practice. So yeah, I think for me, it's important and it's important for all of us in the process of decolonizing, in the process of shedding, you know, white-centered ways of thinking and being, to realize that so many of these practices, you know, were in scripture, and so many of these practices have been around forever, and certainly not deemed evil by God, as we can see through many of the stories in the Bible.
Yeah, I know, to think that God created all, you know, the amazing diversity of herbal, you know, potency in medicine and healing and fragrances and, you know, all of the components. It's just kind of an awesome thing to consider.
Yeah.
I want to ask you about chapter 5 and telling the truth. As a Black woman, I can just express an opinion and be labeled an angry Black woman and call devices. So people in the margins who began to speak the truth are easy targets for, you know, the dominant culture saying, no, this is divisive. Even, and maybe more so in the church, where especially women are supposed to be hush-hush about things. So why is it vital to speak the truth in love to power, especially today when there are so many people that repress the truth and embrace these dangerous lies? And I'm seeing a lot of that repressing the truth in the evangelical church right now and embracing lies that really, I think it really hurts the reputation of evangelical Christians right now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is just power, right? I think of that verse, you know, peace they say, but there is no peace. And I think that, you know, to maintain the peace or to maintain the power, you have to maintain the quote unquote peace, and who's experiencing the peace, you know? And I think that that's something, you know, we know about the Pax Romana, where it was like, you know, one of the most brutal times for people. But yet there was peace, right? There was no war. And so therefore, no one was really suffering, you know, everything was fine. And I think that that's, we've been living under, you know, sort of a Pax Americana, you know, in that, you know, those in power have been claiming that there is peace, because if we don't have, you know, if no one's saying anything, if we're just keeping quiet in our misery and in our pain and in our oppression and our subjugation, then everything's fine. But yeah, I think there is something, you know, crucial to, again, survival, to being full humans, to be able to say the truth, like there is no peace. I'm not experiencing peace. You know, because those who are you know, living under these systems are the ones that are not experiencing peace. And so there is an importance in speaking truth to power so that we can all experience liberation. And I think that that's the goal. I mean, if we want to all be free, then it's important to call out, you know, these, whatever lack of peace we are experiencing. And I know for me, just as you mentioned, the evangelical church for women, you know, I think, again, I had no prior experience to evangelicalism. And I was raised by a single mother and a single grandmother. So for me being a woman, you know, I was raised to be assertive and to speak my mind because there was no man in my life that I had to submit to, right? So when I arrived in these spaces where, you know, I had to, you know, obviously because I was a woman, but also because I was a Cuban woman, I had very different ways of communicating with many different ways of just being in the world. And that was offensive to a lot of folks. It was offensive to a lot of folks that I was taught to be, you know, assertive person. You know, and yeah, and really just speaking up and not necessarily about anything that was quote unquote, just speaking up in general, you know, yeah, it was considered divisive. But I had mentioned in Abuelita Faith, you know, it's interesting that speaking up against things like sexism and racism and, you know, ableism and all these things, all these isms, speaking up for them is considered divisive, but actually being those things, like being sexist and racist and ableist and, you know, is not, you know, that to me is, again, it just goes back to this idea of a fake peace. And so, yeah. And I, you know, I've seen a change I'm seeing a change, you know, that we are starting to speak up because, you know, many of us are beginning to reclaim our power and, that is going to upset the dominant culture, right. And, concern them even more because in the dominant culture's eyes, you know, power is something that, you know, we can't all have power. We can't all be equal in that, you know, only a few of us can hold it and keep it. And So yeah, I think it's a matter of us continuing to speak up and naming what is divisive and not acting like if us doing so is the thing that is divisive. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you for that. I want to touch on, you have a whole chapter on creating, and we have a lot of focus in our community around creativity and the creative arts. And I love that you talk about, you know, what making things by hand has to teach us, how capitalism has really destroyed this sacred art of co-creation through art making. So I'd love to hear more about that. I know our community would really especially love to hear you speak to that in particular, the power of art and what we've lost and what we can regain.
Yeah, that was something that's been so special for me. You know, my grandmother, as I mentioned in the book, she made clothes for a living. And, you know, I would love to just watch her and watch her hands and how her hands held so much wisdom and so much power. And, you know, how she would use her hands to serve those in our communities and you know, doing research on this and learning about how art making and how particularly sewing and, you know, as it pertains to this chapter, has been used in both spiritual and physical, you know, has been used as spiritual and physical ways throughout history. You know, again, looking to Indigenous and African spirituality and how garments and clothes play such a big role in, yeah, just your faith and your spirituality and obviously, you know, protection and, you know, so many things and warmth and all of that. But there's so much in doing this with your hands. And I think that because it's used in spiritual ways, the process is even a spiritual thing. And I saw this in my grandmother's life, you know, the process of creating clothes, how that was like a prayer for her, you know, how she would sit for hours in almost meditation, you know, creating these gorgeous things out of, you know, nothing. I think of God, you know, sewing together clothes, you know, in the garden for Adam and Eve and the, you know, the first humans. I think of Tabitha in the New Testament. You know, I absolutely adore her story, because, you know, it's sort of short and in passing, you know, and we don't know anything about her. I mean, she's called a disciple, which to me is interesting. You know, there's not many women. Well, there isn't any other woman in the New Testament specifically called a disciple, but she is. And they're called on, Peter's called on to resurrect her from the dead. I mean, not many people in the New Testament are resurrected from the dead, right? Other than Jesus, maybe like one or two other people. So why, you know, when, as I read her, you know, as I was writing this book and reading her story, I was just wondering, well, what is it about Tabitha that she's a disciple? She's resurrected from the dead. And we know nothing other than she sewed clothes. She made clothes for the widows in her community. That she was a woman of bodily wisdom. And it was that bodily wisdom that served the group of people that God continuously calls God's people to serve, the widows, right? Like she was doing the thing, and her life was, you know, obviously all of our lives are worthy of resurrection, but her life, you know, during this time was worthy of resurrection. And to me, that is so intricately connected to this notion of co-creation and, you know, art making and using her bodily wisdom and creating with her hands. You know, I talk about the as you do quoted the idea of capitalism. And, you know, I realized this one day as I was, you know, my grandmother obviously used to make all my clothes as a young child. And then, you know, as I grew up, obviously I would buy my, you know, go to the store and buy clothes. And then I would come home to her. And she would always, you know, she would touch it and she would rub her fingers through my clothes. And she just kind of just had this concerned look on her face. And, you know, where'd you get this? And I'd tell her the store and she just felt like they don't, you know, she would literally say they don't do things the way they used to. And she's right. I mean, if you actually look into the clothes making industry, I mean, it is one of the most global injustice, you know, the industries with the most global injustices. I mean, thousands upon thousands of people die every year because fast fashion is just, it's lost that. It's lost that spirituality. I mean, of course, capitalism just wants to make more to sell more, right? And so you have all of these people dying. Not only that, but I mean, it's one of the largest industries with child, you know, labor and child, you know, child slavery. I mean, it is just abhorrent, really. And you think something that was such a sacred and spiritual thing. And so I think for us, you know, we can reclaim that by just working with our hands. I mean, not all of us are going to be skilled in sewing. I mean, I still buy my clothes. I try and buy ethically, but I still buy my clothes, right? And so, yeah, it's just a matter of how can I use my hands to just sort of reclaim that that spirituality. Yeah, and also, you know, just try and buy ethically.
Well, I love that image of the co-creation and the way that art participates in resurrection, and how, when you said, you know, Tabitha's life was worthy of resurrection, is a beautiful, I mean, of course we all, you know, we say that we all are, and the story tells us that, you know, she as a creator was, for whatever reason, that story was highlighted.
Exactly. So,
yeah. Anyway, thank you. It's a gift to ponder those questions.
Yeah.
Kat, I love how you intersect your own lived experience with your family's spiritual narrative, and also with these people in the margins in the Bible. Could you tell us why it's important for you to make all of these connections?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, kind of going back to what I was just saying, this connection between, you know, it's so easy to overlook something like in Tabitha's story that she sewed, that she used her hands. It's easy to overlook that, you know. I remember just hearing her story and throughout seminary, and it was kind of, you know, the focus was Peter and the focus was the resurrection and the focus was not on Tabitha and the fact that she sewed. And so I think for me, making these connections with my own grandmother and seeing, well, no, wait a minute, there's something here, right? There's something beautiful and life-giving here. And it's as simple as sewing. And it's not simple, right? As we just talked about, I mean, it is this act of creation and co-creation. And like, as you mentioned, you know, resurrection, which is so beautiful, that image. But yeah, that's so easy to overlook these things. And so for me, it's important to draw these connections because, you know, that's really what I'm trying to argue in Awadita Faith, is that, you know, these are acts of theology. This is theologizing, you know, this is living lives of faith, of deep faith, It is these things that we so easily overlook, like the dancing, like Miriam, you know, pulling out her timbrel and dancing. You know, I have a chapter that my grandmother, I mean, that was a form of, you know, life giving for her, you know. It is the sewing and the art making. It is these things that, you know, as I mentioned, are overlooked because we look to the big stories and we look to the big characters and we miss, you know, all of those in between and, you know, unrecognized theologians. So I think that for me, it was really important to draw all these connections because it's not just my life, it's all of our lives, right? Because all of our lives are lived in these everyday lived experience, you know, realities, you know, it was important for me to draw these stories out so that they can benefit, so we can see all of ourselves and all of our ancestors, and particularly those of us who are ancestors and who have been marginalized. And it was important for me for those of us to see ourselves in these stories.
Thank you.
Yeah, I love how there's such a there's such an honoring and reverencing of your grandmother and your ancestors and of course the women, but there's also this like beautiful reverencing of like the slowing down to pay attention to the small details, which is so lovely. And the lifting up of what seems like the small thing and making it into the big thing. I want to, we're kind of running out of time, but I want to end with just to have you talk a little bit more about dance. You've talked about it now a couple times with Miriam and the timbrel, and then mentioning your grandmother, and you talk about dance as this embodied form of knowing. And I think, of course, it connects back to what we're talking about, intuitive wisdom. But it's a very much an important image in our community as well, this way of honoring how the body speaks to us of the divine, of the sacred, and how, you know, is a channel for the grief and the celebration. So tell us more what you learned about what dance can teach us, you know, about the things that our mind can't understand.
Yeah, I think it's exactly that. You know, our minds, there's something in our body, there's something that our bodies know that our minds, you know, can't always process. And I think, again, going back to all these things like art making and dancing and all the ways that we use our bodies, I mean, those are forms of knowledge. Our bodies tell stories. Our bodies, you know, our bodies have energy and things that you know, it wants to say and ways, things that it needs to release, whether that's joy or anger, or, you know, there's so much that our body is constantly telling us. But when we, you know, kind of restrict that or hinder that, you know, I think it really does a disservice to our healing, our growth, our own, you know, just being people in the world. And I think that was something, you know, for, as I saw dance growing up, and something that my grandmother, I mean, she went dancing like every weekend. And as I look back, I see that was so healing for her, living in exile, you know, living in a country that's not her own. You know, I always say that she's well into her 90s now, and she has dementia, and but she'll literally to this day still say that, you know, I'm going to be buried in a land not my own, right? She's going to be buried here in the US, and it's not her land, which I find so fascinating because she's lived here for like 50 years, you know, and you'd think that after 50 years of living on a land that it would feel like yours, but it doesn't. And so I feel like just knowing that about her, and knowing that there was a space for her to just be and to let all of that out, for her body to be free, for her body to grieve, for her body to experience joy within her community. And I think that's what was important. You know, she would go with her community and her people, and together, you know, they would experience this, this bodily, you know, release, or, you know, so many things were happening, not just release, but this bodily wisdom. And so I think that, it was beautiful to witness that growing up, and how something like that can be turned again, you know, the narrative can change, the dominant culture can make that become something that it's not. But for my grandmother, and even for myself, you know, I talk about how when I was in the evangelical space that I was in, and I felt very, suppressed in because I was a woman and because I was a Cuban woman. And, you know, I would go dancing with my roommate who was a Black woman from the South. And, you know, back then I couldn't articulate what that meant for us. But now looking back, I mean, that was a space where we could be, you know, where when we were weighed down by systems of, you know, patriarchy and systems of white supremacy, I mean, that was a space where we can be our full selves. And I think the same thing for my grandmother, you know, she could be, you know, as she was weighed down by systems of all the systems that she was weighed down by. There was a space for her to experience joy. And I think all of that, we've been talking about tension, but I think all of that is wrapped together. She can grieve, she can experience joy, she can have fun. And all those complicated things of what it means to be human, I think we can feel that and experience that when we move our bodies, because it's, you know, it's both grief and joy.
Thank you, Kat. And thank you so much for this beautiful book. It's called Abuelita Faith, What Women on the Margins Teach Us About Wisdom, Persistence, and Strength. And I highly recommend that you buy it and you read it slowly, carefully, and maybe dance in between each of the chapters to let it sink into your body. So thank you so much for joining us. It's really been a delight to have this conversation with you.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It was so fun to chat with you both, and thank you for all your great questions.